And at this time, I'd like to introduce our speaker. Her name is Raquel. She's awesome. She's kind of new to the area, but we love her. So.
Thank you for asking me to speak. I really appreciate it. A little nervous. I haven't spoken in a while, so just bear with me. I have a sobriety date. It's April 22nd of 2008. So I just took 2 years in April. So super amazing. I have a sponsor that has a sponsor. Super important. And that sponsor also works the 12 steps out of the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous. And that's what I was taught when I first came in, that that's where the steps need to be worked out of. And I have a home group. I actually have two. I'm super lucky. I moved here from Huntington Beach 3 years ago, so I still have my home group there, which is the Sometime After 7 book study at my sponsor's on Saturday night. And my home group here is the women's meeting in the Presbyterian Church in Orchid on Saturday mornings at 9:30. Okay. So, for what it was like, I think that for what it was like, I can look at what the events were that was happening, and I'll talk about that. But the first thing is, where was I at, you know, physically, mentally, and spiritually? That was the deal for me, was what did I feel like inside? On a physical level, you know, I was definitely sick. I think a lot of us are physically sick by the time that we come in. Pretty much I threw up a lot, and the 6 months before I came in, I'd been throwing up blood. So my solution was not to get sober. My solution was not to go to the doctor. My solution was to mix Pedialyte with vodka and drink that until I could keep it down, because I needed that liquor inside of me so bad. And going to a doctor and figuring out why I was bleeding while I was throwing up was not an option for me, because I wasn't willing to do what their solution would be, which would be to stop drinking. So on a mental and spiritual level, I was trying to figure out how I could describe that, because sometimes when I get nervous, I'm not super good with my words. And I realized that something happened this week that is a really good example for me, not just of how I felt when I first came in, but also of how my alcoholism is still running around inside me. I'm dating somebody that does trail runs, and so I did some trail running a couple weeks ago, and it was super fun. So I'm pet sitting right now in the Orchid by Rice Ranch, you know, up in the hills by where there's trails. And I have never lived somewhere with wilderness right outside the door. I've always been a city girl. So on Thursday, I decided that instead of my run that I usually do in the morning, I was gonna go run the trails before I needed to start dog walking. And did not listen to that you're not supposed to go run trails you don't know if you don't know them by yourself. So definitely, self-will run riot when the Big Book talks about that. That is so still who I am. I don't want to listen to what other people have to say. I want to go do it on my own. I just want to say I got this. Like, I just do. I want to do what I want to do. And that's pretty much what I did. So definitely have fun running downhill. Kept running because I was having so much fun. And then the trail ran out. So then I jogged onto another little trail, thinking it would be so simple to just backtrack and come right back up. But it wasn't. So I turned back around, and then there were all these other trails. So needless to say, at some point I got lost. And I just kept running uphill, going, okay, well, I think I know where I'm at. And eventually I didn't. And I looked all around me, and there were no more houses. I didn't know where I was at, and I was super, super scared. And that's where I was at when I came into Alcoholics Anonymous. I was so scared and so lonely. And that fear in the pit of my stomach, while it's not as bad now when I get lost in the woods, it just was so prevalent. Like, I just I was lost. There's that emptiness inside, that loneliness. Like, I didn't see anyone running when I was out there. And that realization of there's no one else around anymore. That's how I felt. And I hope I never forget that. I didn't see a way out. When I first came into Alcoholics Anonymous, I didn't see that there was a solution. The only thing that I saw was when I sat in the rooms, I saw people in the rooms that were happy. And they had a little bit of a sparkle in their eye that I wanted. So I was willing to give Alcoholics Anonymous a try. And I did obviously make it back okay. I just kept climbing, trying to find houses to look at. And eventually I climbed, and a service road was ending, and there was a big gate that was locked. And I figured that service road went somewhere. So I climbed the gate, the fence, like an 8-foot fence, and managed to run and ended up right back where I was pet sitting. So, but that's me. I want to do it my way. I want to say I got it, but I don't. And I need to listen to other people, and I need to reach out when I don't know what I'm doing and when I'm lost. And so that was the easiest way that I could put it as far as how I felt. That fear inside of me was so strong when I came in. The fear of what was for the rest of my life going to be like. I didn't have an option. I had to quit drinking. But where does that leave me if I don't have a solution? I can quit drinking, but is my life any different? If I'm lost when I'm drinking, then I drink and I just numb it all out. Like, I can be lost in the woods and I'll just be happy because I'm drunk. And then, you know, you get not drunk and the reality sinks in. My MO when I was drinking towards the end would have been to just drink and pass out. And then when I came to is to just drink and pass out again, so I didn't have to face the realities that were going on in my life. And that's what I was doing when I came into AA. The facts that were going on in my life, or the events would be a better way to put it, was that I think that things get put in our lives for a reason, and they had some things that happened that were conduits to get me into AA. I went on a vacation with the boyfriend that I had at the time to Puerto Vallarta, and it was our first night there. We've obviously been drinking since we got on the plane, but I was passed out in the room, and for some reason, he got up on our balcony and fell 3 stories down. He survived. Not like he died, but the reality was is that I was on the floor maybe 3-4 feet away from him and had no idea that he had fallen over that balcony. And nobody found him down there. We never figured out how long he was there. He had blood coming from his ears. He was broken bones, had bit through his tongue half the way. It was just not pretty. He managed to get back up to our room, and he was screaming. And I will never forget that scream because he had cut through half of his tongue. So the scream was just not a normal scream. And all I remember is yelling at him to shut up. Like, that's where I was at. And when I finally turned on the lights and there was blood everywhere, I will always remember that I took a drink first before I called the front desk in panic mode of what do I do? He ended up getting strapped to a surfboard, and they rushed him in a truck to a little Mexican hospital, and he ended up being okay. But I sat for those 10 days in that little hospital with him, feeling sorry for myself because my vacation had been ruined, and I couldn't not drink. So every time that I needed more to drink, I would just say I was gonna go to the restroom. And I would go next door to the bar and have a drink and then come back. And that's basically how I spent those 10 days with him. It's a reminder for me that I chose my drink. I chose the alcohol over somebody else's life. I didn't know, how severe his injuries were when I chose to drink. Or for that matter, just leave him in the hospital. It was a little tiny hospital. They didn't have any of the stuff they needed to, like, they had an ultrasound, I think. That was the only thing they had there. So he came into program with me. So we both had an issue. So when he got out of the hospital, we were upset that our vacation had been, you know, cut short. So we stayed longer when we should have gotten him back to the U.S. And then when we finally came home, he stopped drinking. Like, he was like, you know what, I need to take a break. And I couldn't. And so he went to work, and I couldn't stop drinking. And I remember the day that I was in the kitchen with the freezer open, with my gallon of vodka, drinking from that gallon, and he was going to work. And he had the most disgusted look on his face. And we were talking later that day on the phone, and, you know, I had gotten back to the point of being suicidal and just not knowing what to do with my life. And so the MO for me had been that usually people would put me in the hospital, mental hospital, because I do have some mental health problems. So that was what he was saying. He's like, maybe we need to take you back to the hospital. And for the first time, I said, you know what, I need to stop drinking, and I can't, and I don't know what to do. And that was the first time that I can legitimately say that there was a God consciousness there, that God kind of stepped in and put those words in my mouth, because when I got off the phone, I was not happy. I was not happy those words had come out of my mouth, because I didn't want to stop. I didn't want to stop, but you know, sometimes God steps in there and puts those things there. So, you know, he talked to his people at work and was like, what do I do with her? So they said, you send her to AA. And he called central office in Huntington, and he took me to a meeting that night. And I've stayed since that night. Like I said, I sat in that room and I saw something that I wanted. I don't really remember anything that was said in that meeting, other than that they read a portion of chapter 3, and there's a paragraph in there that talks about all the things that we do in order to try to keep drinking, that taking a trip, not taking a trip, you know. I would read the whole thing, but it's long. But basically, you know, the switching from scotch to brandy and all of these things, and I got that. Like, I got to sit in that room and go, oh my God, I've done that. I switched from tequila to vodka, because I thought that would solve the problem. I switched from doing mixed drinks to just doing shots, because I thought that would fix the problem. The trying to the time, like, I won't drink before this time or that time. And none of it worked, ever. So I remember that from my first meeting. I remember seeing people that had a shine in their eyes, and I remember that specific paragraph, and I got it. And I was able to sit there and go, okay, I get it. Now what do I do? So I went to my second meeting the next day, and I did what people told me to do. People said to get a sponsor. I got a temporary sponsor. People pointed out, like, here's a couple women that would possibly be good sponsors for you, and I went up to one and I asked her to be my sponsor, because I knew I wasn't gonna make it home and not drink that night. Like, I just didn't know how. I didn't know how to go home from work and not do a shot as soon as I walked in the door. I didn't know how to not drink at 3-4 in the morning, because I needed to get back to sleep, or I had the shakes so bad. I needed to have a sponsor to be accountable to, and I needed to have somebody that had worked the 12 steps. And I needed meetings. I was told 90 meetings in 90 days, and I did a meeting every day for my whole first year, usually multiple meetings a day. Whatever I needed to do to stay sober, I did. I listened to the old timers and I took commitments. I got volunteered for a lot of commitments, and thank God, you know, that I did coffee and so many meetings and literature commitments and birthday commitments. And my home group, the sponsor that I had asked to sponsor me was a member of the Big Book, Bellflower Big Book Group, which is an offshoot of the Pacific Group out of LA. So they are very structured. And they're very structured, a little militant, and I needed that. I needed the structure. I needed people to say, look, this is what you will do. I was suggested that I have a book study, a 12 and 12, a woman's meeting, a speaker meeting, and then a discussion meeting, that I need to study the literature. That is the program of AA. So I got a super good base. Now their commitment for newcomers is being a greeter. And that meeting is so large that the greeting line is all the way down, like it's a humongous auditorium, and it's literally the whole wall. And I used to stand in that line and just cry and shake people's hands and just pretend that I wasn't crying. And it worked. Like, it worked. People never looked down at me. We've all been there. We've all been there. So that was my start in Alcoholics Anonymous. The God thing was a struggle for me. I grew up, and I'll talk a little bit about my upbringing in a minute, because a lot of my program based around resentments, things like that I had from my upbringing. I grew up in an atheist home in Utah. I grew up in Utah till I was about 15 and a half, 16. But in an atheist home, which made everything extremely confusing. If there had been a Bible in our house, my mom probably would have burned it. I didn't have a concept of faith. I know a lot of people talk about how when they were drinking, they prayed to God that they would just, like, if they just get them out of this bind, then they wouldn't drink anymore. Like, that was never the case for me, because I didn't ever even have a concept of praying to something or thinking that someone was out there that had my back. So when I came in and the steps told me that I needed to have a belief in a higher power, I wanted to give up. I felt like I wasn't going to get it. I wasn't going to be able to get what everybody else had in the room, because I didn't understand a God. The first thing that got pointed out to me is that it's a God of my own understanding. And I related much better to the word higher power than I did to God. Higher power, I could have some level of connection to with nature, energy, those types of things. In the 12 and 12, in step 3, it talks about the key of willingness, that if we can just take the key of willingness and put it in the lock and open the door just a tiny, tiny little bit to a power greater than ourselves, then that's what we need. That's all we need, is this tiny little opening. And I realized that I could get that if I just looked at a couple things that had happened in my life. Where I knew something else had been out there. I had a suicide attempt when I was in foster care. And I remember waking up in the hospital, and the doctor was there, and my foster parents were there, and they were just like, we don't know. We don't know why you survived, because you shouldn't have. So I had a couple moments like that where it was just enough for me to know that there was something else that was going on, and that was all I needed to be able to start the steps and to be able to have that belief in a higher power that I needed to work my second and my third step. Spirituality is a gradual process for me, and it was pretty slow initially, and that's okay. Like, my God lets me take things in my own time. And I love, in the spiritual experience, it's in Appendix 2 at the back of the book, it talks about, specifically talks about the fact that when the book was written, a lot of the experiences initially in the book are those huge aha moments, like Bill's story, like, oh my God, just God appeared, and they just got it. And that's not my story. And so then it talks about that most of AA people, we get our spirituality and our belief in a higher power by the educational variety, meaning that it happens over time. And that's been the case for me, is that it has happened over time. And about 9 years sober, I got away from program. I got some resentments, and I hadn't been growing spiritually, and I pretty much was gonna go out. If you look at the stories in the big book, all of them, in the first 164 pages, almost all of them that talk about relapse, talk about that the person failed to enlarge their spiritual condition, that they didn't continue to grow in a relationship with the higher power. And that's where I was at that point in my sobriety. And definitely I got to see that God works in odd ways for me, because I don't always get it. So I hadn't had a sponsor in a while, and I hadn't been to meetings in a while. I was not doing good. I was pretty much back to how I felt when I was drinking when I came in, only I wasn't drinking. I was like completely sober and out of my mind. And during that time, I went to a car wash and got in an accident inside the car wash. So like somebody stopped, and then like the conveyor belt didn't stop. So I ended up hitting the person in front of me, who was then hitting the person in front of her. So we all get out, and myself and the other lady, we exchange information. She's super nice. I'm running around with no shoes on because I've just been to yoga and I always forgot my shoes. And then we go our separate ways. And during all of that time, I had been talking to my hairdresser who was in program, and she kept telling me about this meeting on Saturday night at her sponsor's house that she kept asking me to come to. And I kept saying I would, and I kept not coming. Only maybe 2-3 months after that accident, I suddenly just decided to go because I was so desperate. And I walked in that house, and it was her house, and she was the sponsor. And that was her meeting. And that's how God connected me with the sponsor I have now. And she's the one that brought me through the steps where I needed to grow in spirituality. She was the connection that I needed. She had that spirituality. She had that faith that I felt like I'd never get. You know, the people in meetings that are just so at peace and can just turn things over to God. And I just didn't get it. But she had that. And I asked her one day what was God to her. And she told me that God to her was inside of her heart and her spirit and her soul. And that's what God was, that God lived within her. And I got it. And that was my moment as far as a spiritual experience, when I really began to grow spiritually. And that took 9 years. And that's okay. Like, I get to grow in my own time, and my higher power is, like, just works with me on that. I can say today that I pretty much know that God's got my back, and life is not always good, and life is not always easy, but I can know my higher power has my back. And when I'm really struggling, I use a God box. So I write down things I need to turn over, and I read them out loud, and I physically put them in the box so that I have the actual, like, action of going, okay, like, I'm turning this over. This is what I'm doing. So that works really well for me. So I'll backtrack just really fast on my upbringing. I grew up in a not good situation, and a lot of us have them. Definitely a significant amount of abuse in my home, and to the point that a special investigative unit for the police had to get involved. And I was very blessed that when I was 12 years old, they were able to bring in court orders and get into my house and arrest people, and I was removed and put into foster care. The things that were going on in the home are things that kids should never go through, things that kids should never see. I was so thankful that I went into foster care. It was such a blessing for me. It was a situation and a circumstance that was so much better than what I was living in. And the only reason I really go over the upbringing stuff is because when I drank, a lot of my drinking was just, it was to numb out. Like, I don't want to feel. That was my whole life. It's just, I don't want to feel whatever's going on inside of me. And so much of it were the feelings that were built during those years. The shame and the guilt and the self-hatred and, oh my God, the resentments. Like, I mean, how do we ever work through resentments about things like that if we don't have a program? If we don't have people to help us understand how to move past and move through those things. So my solution was alcohol for that, to get through each day. In order for me to stay sober, I have to work a program of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I have to work on those resentments in order to stay sober. I think that's enough on that, because it's a little late. Other than, let's see, there was the dad. I got shipped to my dad to live with him when I was 16, that I didn't know, but it got me to Washington State. That didn't work out so well, so I moved out when I was in high school, in my senior year in high school. Got married at 19. That was a domestic violence issue, because I walked right back into what I grew up in, which we do if, unfortunately, we stay victims. And we put ourselves back in the same situations that we're familiar with until we learn how to not be victims and until we get the help that we need. And that was where I was at. And so luckily got help there, was able to relocate and get away from that at 21, promptly met who became the second husband, and ended up divorced twice by the time I was, I think, 28 or 29 years old. And I moved to California because I felt that was the solution. Super glad I moved to California also. And I lived 20 years in Huntington Beach and I loved it there. But I just was running away from it all. All of those feelings were still there. And when I came into Alcoholics Anonymous, I remember somebody told me that that there was the beauty of getting sober was that I got to feel my feelings. I get to feel the things that are going on in my life today, but that the difficult thing about getting sober is that I feel my feelings. And what do I do when I feel my feelings and I don't have alcohol to numb them out? And that's what the 12 steps gives me, is that it gives me the constructive, this is a new way to live your life. So, like I said, resentments were very big issues for me when I came in. And the one thing I always remember is on page 64, right on the other side of the columns, it's very clear that resentments are our number one offender. Resentments will take more people out and get them into a relapse than anything else. And I believe that. I've seen it happen. I know when I'm on edge, it's almost always over resentment that I haven't dealt with. So I got to work my fourth and my fifth step right away. And I know a lot of people get scared of the fourth step. I didn't let myself even take the time. I was desperate. People said I needed to work a fourth step. I worked that fourth step. And I knew I didn't have to do it perfect. Like, this is progress, not perfection. We get to work on the steps. We get to continually work on these things for the rest of our lives. So you do the best that you can. How I did my fourth step that initial time varied greatly from how I do a fourth step now and the depth that I can go into things. In working the initial fourth step, I got enough of a relief that I could let go of a lot of those feelings. And then over time, it got to the point where I could have empathy for my biological mom and for the people that were in my home and some of the things that had been being done. But I didn't reach a level of forgiveness right away, and that was okay. Like, I got to have sponsors that told me to be gentle with myself when I started tackling those kinds of things. But the beauty of the program is that I never thought forgiveness would ever be somewhere that I could reach. But I have. Was actually when I moved up here, it was a speaker meeting I heard here. And the speaker had talked about something that had happened that was really bad with a parent and something that had happened all the way. He had talked about an experience and then he had to do amends. And what he had said about it was that he realized that he didn't know his parents' story. And I got that. I don't know I don't know my biological mom's story. I don't know my stepdad's story or the story of the men that lived in my home. I don't know. I don't know what brought them to where they were at and what happened in their lives that they felt that certain things were okay. I just don't know. And you know what, to be really honest, it's not my business. Like, I get to move on with my life. I get to let go of that stuff and live a good, healthy, at-peace life. And so that was my first really reaching a level of forgiveness. I had reached empathy. With my mental illness runs really heavy in my family. And so with my biological mom, I did reach a level of empathy with her in that she is very sick. She's very sick mentally. And so, you know, I got to really just step back and just go, you know what, it's not all about me. Things in my fourth step, I got to separate. I separate the person from the event. So number one, I always acknowledge that things that happen that are traumatic, they're not good. You know, when they say look at your part in the fourth step, it doesn't mean that I go and I say this is my fault that something happened to me. I acknowledge that those things happened and they were very traumatic and have long-standing effects. They affect how I cope with things. They mean I have to get help for certain things. But I get to separate away the person and I just get to let them go. And I get to let just that resentment and that hatred, and it just does no good. So I had gotten to the point where I realized that I don't know their story. And then the last little part that I just couldn't let go, I realized recently, and that was that most people in my life just simply didn't have the capacity to give more than they gave. And the reality is that whether it's looking at things in my past or severe trauma and perpetrators of that, or whether it's looking at a resentment that I have today at somebody, people give as much as they have to give. And I can't ask somebody to give something that is greater than the capacity that they have to give it. It doesn't mean that I have to have that person in my life. It doesn't mean that I have to say that what they're doing is okay. It means that I get to do what I need to do to separate myself, deal with my own stuff, get help when I need it, and I let them be with their God and figure it out. It's not my job. Not my job anymore to teach people lessons. That's always my big one. When I'm in my head and I just want to teach somebody a lesson, that is my automatic, that something is not quite right in my head. So that was kind of on my fourth and my fifth. So there's a paragraph. I'm not going to read the whole thing, but it's on page 417. It's called the acceptance paragraph. It's an amazing paragraph. I used to have it pinned. Well, we'll just say my big book is falling apart. Like, the pages are falling out. It is falling apart right at page 417. I had to open it so much. And it talks about that nothing happens in God's world by mistake. And that when I'm disturbed, I need to look away from what I feel everybody else is doing wrong. And I need to look at my own attitude. And I need to look at what am I doing? How am I living my life? How am I treating the people around me? What's my part in the situation that's happening? The biggest thing that I take now out of that paragraph is that nothing, absolutely nothing, happens in God's world by mistake. And I get that now. Like, there are some really bad things that have happened in my life. But like the big book says, sometimes our most traumatic things, sometimes the most difficult things that happen in our life, they become our biggest assets. And that's what the case has been for me. I inevitably end up with girls in my life or people around me that I can help now because of where I've been at, because of the things I've seen, and the growth that I've done through those things and where I've come to today. So whenever I go through a difficult time, it's not that I'm all Pollyanna and thinking that everything's all right. But I know in my head where I can do a thought process and go, okay, these things are happening for a reason. I may not know, I may not be able to see what that end result will be, but there's a reason. And there's good things that end up coming out of it, no matter how bad. So that's been a huge growth for me, is that it just is a weight off my shoulders. Like, I get to let go. The steps let me just let go and live my life and be a good person and help other people. Like, how rarely in the real world do we learn how important it is to help other people and just be kind. Kind, love, and tolerant. It took me a long time to learn that, that that's a way that I should live my life. I have in the past had issues with road rage, and especially on my motorcycle, it's been a problem. Now, I watch my road rage. When I start to get it and I start to wind up, and I have almost broken my habit of flipping people off, which was a bad habit down south. When I catch myself having that behavior, I automatically know that something's wrong with my spiritual condition. Like, I am not healthy when I start to have road rage. When I start to feel that everybody else in my life is doing something wrong, that I need to teach them something. When I start to fall into that thought process, it's an automatic red flag for me. And so, you know, I get to learn the pause when agitated, which is not natural to pause when agitated. I used to want to get a tattoo on my wrist, so to say, like a pause button, so I could press it. But I'm really glad I didn't do that, because in the corporate world where I used to work, that would have been hard to explain. So, you know, coming into, you know, going through the fourth and the fifth step, and then coming into the sixth and the seventh, looking at defects of character. The sixth and the seventh step only have two paragraphs in the big book. One of them is the seventh step prayer. And so it's easily overlooked. And I know when I first got sponsored, we didn't really do much with the sixth and the seventh step, but I've gotten to be able to go a lot more detailed into that as I've been sober longer. And for me, the sixth and the seventh steps are probably the most important steps that I can work. If I'm looking at my resentments and I'm recognizing them when they happen, and I'm working through to look at my heart, but then I'm not actually doing something to remove the character defect that is resulting in the resentments, then I'm just gonna keep going round in circles. I'm just gonna keep getting resentments, and I'm gonna keep trying to work the Collins. But if I look at the actual defects of character and I ask them to be removed, then I start to make progress. My big defects are almost always the self ones. Selfishness, self-centeredness, a lot of self-centeredness, and ego. And I could have sworn when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous that ego was never an issue for me, but it comes up over and over and over again. The deciding I can run, no matter what anybody else says, the trails and the wilderness that I have no idea where I'm going, that's ego. Like, I wanna think that I know everything. I wanna think that I can do it all. The being nervous about speaking, ultimately it really is ego, because I worry about how are you gonna think when what I should worry about is what words should just be coming out of my mouth and what's natural. And it's something, you know, it says in the 12 and 12 that, you know, working the sixth and the seventh step is a lifetime job. It's something that I'll do for the rest of my life. I may, you know, ask for selfishness and self-centeredness to be removed today. It doesn't mean it's not going to come back up tomorrow and that I don't need to work on it again. So I immediately, when I need to work columns on something, and my sponsor is always, when I'm spinning out about something, is go work, did you work the columns? go write your columns. And inevitably, whenever I do that, and I look at my part, and I look at the defects, it's the same ones. And they keep coming up, and so I keep working on them, and recognizing them, and asking for them to be removed. And then I will just talk a little bit about the eighth and the ninth step. The ninth step was my most impactful step. It actually ended up being more impactful my first time around the steps than the fourth and the fifth. There's something about reaching forgiveness for another person that brings a peace inside. And I don't really know how to explain that peace. I think we have to experience it to understand it. But it's a beautiful thing. Just forgiveness is a beautiful thing. I never understood it until I could actually reach it. A big part of what I was taught in working the eighth and the ninth is self-forgiveness. If I can't forgive myself for the things that I have done to myself and to other people, how can I expect that God forgives me? How can I even understand that concept? Like, I have to look at myself and I have to be able to forgive myself. And if I can't forgive myself, how do I forgive other people? Like, how do I even try to process that if I don't know how to forgive myself? So I've had really good sponsors that have walked me through self-forgiveness and working an eighth and a ninth step on myself. And that allows me then to be able to open my heart and forgive a lot of other people. Like, most people out there are doing the best they can, just like I am. And if I can look at them and I can have that compassion for them, the same as I can have for myself, then it opens my heart to not get constant resentments and not treat people the way that I used to treat them. Living amends are a huge part of my eighth and my ninth step, because there are a lot of people that I couldn't go do amends with. I certainly acted in inappropriate ways with some people, or, you know, made bad choices where me physically going in front of that person and giving them amends was not a possibility. Would have damaged other people or harmed other people, whatever the case may be. And so living amends is a huge part of my amends process today and my program. I get to just simply not be the person that I used to be. I get to not use people. I get to not do things that create shame and guilt within myself that cause me to drink again. And I try to remember that. That's that practice our principles. Number step 12, practice the principles in all of our affairs. That is living amends for me. And living amends is staying sober and working the steps. We are almost out of time. So the only other thing that I can really go over that is such a huge part of my program is service. You know, I was very lucky that when I came into Alcoholics Anonymous, I was taught to be of service from day one. I was taught that I have something to give. Even if I just have one more day sober than somebody else, I have something to give. I was taught to respect Alcoholics Anonymous and to give back in the rooms. And even if that just meant cleaning up after a meeting, then I clean up after that meeting and I stay sober that day. I learned that I think we all have our different areas of service that we're good at, that touch our hearts. Like, I love H&I, an inner group, and I won't explain inner group, but hospitals and institutions is where we take panels into institutions and facilities where people can't necessarily get out to do things themselves. And so most of my service work has been in those areas because I love them. But I also learned that sometimes God puts you where you're supposed to be and puts different service work in front of you for a reason. When I moved here 2 weeks before COVID, and this is a much smaller area. I've never lived anywhere small before, and so I thought I could just move here and just get involved again like I was. Well, I went to get involved in H&I, and H&I wasn't around. And COVID happened, so meetings weren't around. An inner group wasn't really something that was active, and I wasn't connected enough anyway to be involved in inner group. And God ended up putting ladies in my life. And that's where I got to be of service, and I get to be of service that way today, that I sponsor more here than I used to sponsor down south. And they just touch my heart. And it's not always happy stories. You know, not everybody makes it, and that's heartbreaking. But I get to be of service, and I get to share how my sobriety works. How was I taken through the 12 steps? I get to take people through the book. And I don't ever know. We don't know how, if one sentence that we say, we don't know how that impacts somebody else. We just don't. We just be of service to the best of our capacity, and we let the, it's doing the footwork, and light, and leave the rest up to God. So that is what I have to share. Thank you for letting me speak.
Another round of it.